Zondervan Audio Pages presents Boundaries, When to Say Yes and When to Say No to Take Control of Your Life by Dr. Henry Cloud and Dr. John Townsend, read by Dick Fredericks.
Boundaries, When to Say Yes, When to Say No to Take Control of Your Life by Henry Cloud and John Townsend. Part 1. What are boundaries? Chapter 1. A Day in a Boundaryless Life. 6 a.m. The alarm jangled. Bleary-eyed from too little sleep, Sherry shut off the noisy intruder, turned on the bedside lamp, and sat up in bed. Looking blankly at the wall, she tried to get her bearings. Why am I dreading this day? Lord, didn't you promise me a life of joy? Then, as the cobwebs left her mind, Sherry remembered the reason for her dread, the 4 o'clock meeting with Todd's third-grade teacher. The phone call returned to her memory.
Sherry, this is Jean Russell. I wonder if we could meet about Todd's performance and his behavior.
Todd couldn't keep still and listen to his teachers. He didn't even listen to Sherry and Walt. Todd was such a strong-willed child, and she didn't want to quench his spirit. Wasn't that more important?
Well, no time to worry about all that, Sherry said to herself, raising her 35-year-old body off the bed and padding to the shower. I've got enough troubles to keep me busy all day.
Under the shower, Sherry's mind moved out of first gear. She began mentally ticking off the day's schedule. Todd 9 and Amy 6 would have been a handful even if she weren't a working mother.
Let's see. Fix breakfast, pack 2 lunches, and finish sewing Amy's costume for the school play.
That will be a trick, finishing sewing the costume before the carpool picks her up at 7:45 a.m. Sherry thought regretfully about last night. She had planned to work on Amy's costume then, using her talents to make a special day for her little girl. But her mother had dropped over unexpectedly. Good manners dictated that she play hostess, and another evening was shot. The memories of her attempts to salvage the time weren't pretty. Trying to be diplomatic, Sherry artfully told her mother,
"You can't imagine how much I enjoy your surprise visits, Mom. But I was wondering, would you mind if I sew Amy's costume while we talk?"
Sherry cringed inwardly, correctly anticipating her mother's response.
"Sherry, you know I'd be the last to intrude on your time with your family."
Sherry's mother, widowed for 12 years, had elevated her widowhood to the status of martyrdom.
"I mean, since your father died, it's been such an empty time. I still miss our family. How could I deprive you of that for yourself?"
"I'll bet I find out how," Sherry thought to herself.
"That's why I can understand why you don't bring Walt and the children to see me much any more. How could I be entertaining? I'm just a lonely old lady who gave her entire life to her children. Who would want to spend any time with me?"
"No, Mom! No, no, no!" Sherry quickly joined the emotional minuet she and her mom had been dancing for decades.
"That's not what I meant at all. I mean, it's so special having you over. Goodness knows, with our schedule, we'd like to visit more, but we just haven't been able to. That's why I'm so glad you took the initiative."
"Lord, don't strike me dead for this little lie," she prayed silently.
"In fact, I can do the costume any old time," Sherry said.
"Forgive me for this lie, too.
Now, why don't I make us some coffee?"
Her mother sighed.
"All right, if you insist. But I'd just hate to think I'm intruding."
The visit lasted well into the night. By the time her mother left, Sherry felt absolutely crazy. But she justified it to herself. "At least I've helped make her lonely day a little brighter." Then a pesky voice piped up. If you helped so much, why was she still talking about her loneliness when she left? Trying to ignore the thought, Sherry went to bed. 6:45 a.m. Sherry returned to the present.
No use crying over spilt time, I guess, she mumbled to herself as she struggled to close the zipper of her black linen skirt. Her favorite suit had become, as many others had, too tight. Middle age spread so soon, she thought. This week I really have to go on a diet and start exercising. The next hour was, as usual, a disaster. The kids whined about getting out of bed, and Walt complained, "Can't you get the kids to the table on time?" 7:45 a.m. Miraculously, the kids made it to their rides, Walt left for work in his car, and Sherry went out and locked the front door after her. Taking a deep breath, she prayed silently, "Lord, I'm not looking forward to this day. Give me something to hope for." In her car on the freeway, she finished applying her makeup. Thank the Lord for traffic jams. 8:45 a.m. Rushing into McAllister Enterprises, where she worked as a fashion consultant, Sherry glanced at her watch. Only a few minutes late. Maybe by now her colleagues understood that being late was a way of life for her and did not expect her to be on time. She was wrong. They had started the weekly executive meeting without her. Sherry tried to tiptoe in without being noticed, but every eye was on her as she struggled into her seat. Glancing around, she gave a fleeting smile and muttered something about that crazy traffic. 11:59 a.m. The rest of Sherry's morning proceeded fairly well. A talented fashion designer, Sherry had an unerring eye for attractive clothing and was a valuable asset to McAllister. The only hitch came just before lunch. Her extension rang.
Sherry Phillips.
"Sherry, thank goodness you're there. I don't know what I'd have done if you'd been at lunch."
There was no mistaking this voice. Sherry had known Lois Thompson since grade school. A high-strung woman, Lois was always in crisis. Sherry had always tried to make herself available to Lois to be there for her. But Lois never asked Sherry how she was doing, and when Sherry mentioned her struggles, Lois either changed the subject or had to leave. Sherry genuinely loved Lois and was concerned about her problems, but Lois seemed more like a client than a friend. Sherry resented the imbalance in their friendship. As always, Sherry felt guilty when she thought about her anger at Lois. As a Christian, she knew the value the Bible placed on loving and helping others.
"There I go again," she would say to herself, "thinking of myself before others. Please, Lord, let me give to Lois freely and not be so self-centered."
Sherry asked,
"What's the matter, Lois?"
"It's horrible! Just horrible!"
Lois said.
"Anne was sent home from school today, Tom was denied his promotion, and my car gave out on the freeway!"
"This is what my life's like every day," Sherry thought to herself, feeling the resentment rising. However, she merely said,
"Lois, you poor thing! How are you coping with all of this?"
Lois was happy to answer Sherry's question in great detail, so much detail that Sherry missed half her lunch break consoling her friend.
"Well," she thought, "fast food's better than no food."
Sitting at the drive-thru waiting for her chicken burger, Sherry thought about Lois. If all my listening, consoling, and advice had made any difference over the years, maybe it would be worth it. But Lois makes the same mistakes now that she made 20 years ago. Why do I do this to myself? 4 o'clock p.m. Sherry's afternoon passed uneventfully. She was on the way out of the office to the teachers' meeting when her boss, Jeff Moreland, flagged her down.
"Glad I caught up with you, Sherry," he said.
A successful figure at McAllister Enterprises, Jeff made things happen. Trouble was, Jeff often used other people to make things happen. Sherry could sense the 100th verse of the same old song tuning up again.
"Listen, I'm in a time crunch," he said, handing her a large sheaf of papers. "This is the data for the final recommendations for the Kimbrough account. All it needs is a little writing and editing, and it's due tomorrow. But I'm sure it'll be no problem for you."
He smiled ingratiatingly. Sherry panicked. Jeff's editing needs were legendary. Hefting the papers in her hands, Sherry saw a minimum of 5 hours' work.
"I had this data into him 3 weeks ago," she thought furiously. Where does this man get off having me save his face for his deadline?
Quickly, she composed herself.
Sure, Jeff. It's no problem at all. Glad I can help. What time do you need it?
9 o'clock would be fine. And thanks, Sherry. I always think of you first when I'm in a jam. You're so dependable. Jeff strolled away.
Dependable, faithful, reliable, Sherry thought.
I've always been described this way by people who wanted something from me. Sounds like a description of a good mule. Suddenly the guilt hit again.
There I am, getting resentful again. Lord, help me bloom where I'm planted.
But secretly she found herself wishing she could be transplanted to another flower pot. 4:30 p.m. Jean Russell was a competent teacher, one of many in the profession who understood the complex factors beneath a child's problem behavior. The meeting with Todd's teacher began as so many before, minus Walt. Todd's father hadn't been able to get off work, so the two women talked alone.
"He's not a bad child, Sherry,"
Mrs. Russell reassured her.
"Todd is a bright, energetic boy. When he minds, he's one of the most enjoyable kids in the class."
Sherry waited for the axe to fall.
"Just get to the point, Jean. I have a problem, child, don't I?
What's new? I have a problem life to go with it." Sensing Sherry's discomfort, the teacher pressed ahead.
"The problem is that Todd doesn't respond well to limits. For example, during our task period, when children work on assignments, Todd has great difficulty. He gets up from his desk, pesters other kids, and won't stop talking. When I mention to him that his behavior is inappropriate, he becomes enraged and obstinate."
Sherry felt defensive about her only son.
"Maybe Todd has an attention deficit problem, or he's hyperactive?"
Mrs. Russell shook her head.
"When Todd's second-grade teacher wondered about that last year, psychological testing ruled that out. Todd stays on task very well when he's interested in the subject. I'm no therapist, but it seems to me that he's just not used to responding to rules."
Now Sherry's defensiveness turned from Todd to herself.
"Are you saying this is some sort of home problem?"
Mrs. Russell looked uncomfortable.
"As I said, I'm not a counselor. I just know that in third grade most children resist rules. But Todd is off the scale. Any time I tell him to do something he doesn't want to, it's World War III. And since all his intellectual and cognitive testing comes out normal, I was just wondering how things were at home."
Sherry no longer tried to hold back the tears. She buried her head in her hands and wept convulsively for a few minutes, feeling overwhelmed with everything. Eventually, her crying subsided.
"I'm sorry. I guess this just hit on a bad day."
Sherry rummaged in her purse for a tissue.
No, it's more than that. Gina, I need to be honest with you. Your problems with him are the same as mine. Walt and I have a real struggle making Todd mind at home. When we're playing or talking, Todd is the most wonderful son I could imagine. But any time I have to discipline him, the tantrums are more than I can handle. So I guess I don't have any solutions for you."
Jean nodded her head slowly.
"It really helps me, Sherry, to know that Todd's behavior is a problem at home, too. Well, at least now we can put our heads together on a solution."
5:15 p.m. Sherry felt strangely grateful for the afternoon rush hour traffic. "At least there's no one tugging on me here," she thought. She used the time to plan around her next crises. Kids, dinner, Jeff's project, church, and Walt. 6:30 p.m.
"For the fourth and last time, dinner's ready!"
Sherry hated to scream, but what else worked? The kids and Walt always seemed to shuffle in whenever they felt like it. More often than not, dinner was cold by the time everyone was assembled. Sherry had no clue what the problem was. She knew it wasn't the food because she was a good cook. Besides, once they got to the table, everyone inhaled it in seconds. Everyone but Amy. Watching her daughter sit silently, picking distractedly at her food, Sherry again felt uneasy. Amy was such a lovable, sensitive child. Why was she so reserved? Amy had never been outgoing. She preferred to spend her time reading, painting, or just sitting in her bedroom, thinking about stuff.
"Honey, what kind of stuff?" Sherry would probe.
"Just stuff,"
would be the usual reply. Sherry felt shut out of her daughter's life. She dreamed of mother-daughter talks, conversations for just us girls, shopping trips. But Amy had a secret place deep inside where no one was ever invited. This unreachable part of her daughter's heart, Sherry ached to touch. 7 p.m. Halfway through dinner, the phone rang. We really need to get an answering machine to handle calls during dinner, Sherry thought. There's precious little time for us to be together as a family anymore. Then, as if on cue, another familiar thought struck her. It might be someone who needs me. As always, Sherry listened to the second voice in her head and jumped up from the table to answer the phone. Her heart sank as she recognized the voice on the other end.
"Hope I'm not disturbing anything,"
said Phyllis Renfro, the women's ministries leader at church.
"Certainly you aren't disturbing anything," Sherry lied again. "Sherry, I'm in deep water," Phyllis said. "Margie was going to be our activities coordinator at the retreat, and now she's canceled. Something about priorities at home. Anyway, you can pitch in."
The retreat. Sherry had almost forgotten that the annual gathering of churchwomen was this weekend. She had actually been looking forward to leaving the kids and Walt behind and strolling around the beautiful mountainous area for 2 days, just herself and the Lord. In fact, the possibility of solitude felt better to her than the planned group activities. Taking on Margie's activities coordinator position would mean giving up her precious alone time. No, it wouldn't work. Sherry would just have to say, automatically. The second thought pattern intervened. What a privilege to serve God and these women, Sherry. By giving up a little portion of your life, by letting go of your selfishness, you can make a big difference in some lives. Think it over. Sherry didn't have to think it over. She had learned to respond unquestioningly to this familiar voice, just as she responded to her mother's, and Phyllis's, and maybe God's, too. Whoever it belonged to, it was too strong to be ignored. Habit won out.
"I'll be happy to help," Sherry told Phyllis.
"Just send me whatever Margie's done and I'll get working on it."
Phyllis sighed, audibly relieved.
"Oh, Sherry, I know it's a sacrifice. Myself, I have to do it several times every day. But that's the abundant Christian life, isn't it? Being living sacrifices."
"If you say so," thought Sherry. But she couldn't help wondering when the abundant part would come in. 7:45 p.m. Dinner finally finished, Sherry watched Walt position himself in front of the TV for the football game. Todd reached for the phone, asking if his friends could come over and play. Amy slipped unobserved to her room. The dishes stayed on the table. The family hadn't quite gotten the hang of helping clean up yet. But maybe the kids were still a little young for that. Sherry started clearing the dishes from the table. 11:30 p.m. Years ago, Sherry could have cleaned up after dinner, gotten the kids to bed on time, and performed Jeff's handed-off project with ease. A cup of coffee after dinner and the adrenaline rush that accompanied crises and deadlines galvanized Sherry into superhuman feats of productivity. She wasn't called Super Sherry for nothing. But it was becoming noticeably harder these days. Stress didn't work like it used to. More and more she was having trouble concentrating, forgetting dates and deadlines, and not even caring a great deal about it all. At any rate, by sheer willpower, she had completed most of her tasks. Maybe Jeff's project had suffered a little in quality, but she felt too resentful to feel bad. But I did say yes to Jeff, Sherry thought. It's not his fault, it's mine. Why couldn't I tell him how unfair it was for him to lay this on me? No time for that now. She had to get on with her real task for the evening, her talk with Walt. Her and Walt's courtship and early marriage had been pleasant. Where she'd been confused, Walt had been decisive. Where she had felt insecure, he'd been strong. Not that Sherry wasn't contributing to the marriage. She saw Walt's lack of emotional connectedness, and she had taken upon herself the job of providing the warmth and love the relationship lacked. God has put together a good team, she would tell herself. Walt has the leadership, and I have the love. This would help her get over the lonely times when he couldn't seem to understand her hurt feelings. But over the years, Sherry noted a shift in the relationship. It started off subtly, then became more pronounced. She could hear it in his sarcastic tone when she had a complaint. She saw it in the lack of respect in his eyes when she tried to tell him about her need for more support from him. She felt it in his increasingly insistent demands for her to do things his way. And his temper. Maybe it was job stress or having kids. Whatever it was, Sherry never dreamed she'd ever hear the cutting, angry words she heard from the lips of the man she had married. She didn't have to cross him much at all to be subjected to the anger. Burnt toast, a checking overdraft, or forgetting to gas up the car, any of these things seemed to be enough. It all pointed to one conclusion. The marriage was no longer a team, if it ever had been one. It was a parent-child relationship with Sherry on the wrong end. At first, she thought she was imagining things. There I go again, looking for trouble when I have a great life, she told herself. That would help for a while, until Walt's next temper attack. Then her hurt and sadness would tell her the truth her mind wasn't willing to accept. Finally realizing that Walt was a controlling person, Sherry took the blame upon herself. I'd be that way, too, if I had a basket case like me to live with, she'd think. I'm the reason he gets so critical and frustrated. These conclusions led Sherry to a solution she had practiced for years, loving Walt out of his anger. This remedy went something like this. First, Sherry learned to read Walt's emotions by watching his temper, body language, and speech. She became exquisitely aware of his moods, and especially sensitive to things that could set him off. Lateness, disagreements, and her own anger. As long as she was quiet and agreeable, things went well. But let her preferences raise their ugly heads, and she risked getting her head lopped off. Sherry learned to read Walt well, and quickly. After sensing that she was crossing an emotional line, she would employ stage two of loving Walt. She did an immediate backtrack, coming around to his viewpoint, but not really. Quietly holding her tongue, or even outrightly apologizing for being hard to live with, all helped. Stage three of loving Walt was doing special things for him to show that she was sincere. This might mean dressing more attractively at home, or making his favorite meals several times a week. Didn't the Bible talk about being this kind of wife? The three steps of loving Walt worked for a time, but the peace never lasted. The problem with loving Walt out of his anger was that Sherry was dead tired of trying to soothe Walt out of his tantrums. Thus, he stayed angry longer, and his anger isolated her more from him. Her love for her husband was eroding. She had felt that no matter how bad things were, God had joined them, and that their love would get them through. But in the past few years, it was more commitment than love. When she was honest, she admitted that many times she could feel nothing at all toward Walt but resentment and fear. And that's what tonight was all about. Things needed to change. Somehow, they needed to rekindle the flames of their first love. Sherry walked into the family room. The late-night comedian on the television screen had just finished his monologue.
"Honey, can we talk?"
she asked tentatively. There was no answer. Moving closer, she saw why. Walt had fallen asleep on the couch. Thinking about waking Walt up, she remembered his stinging words the last time she'd been so insensitive. She turned off the television and lights and walked to the empty bedroom. 11:50 p.m. Lying in bed, Sherry couldn't tell which was greater, her loneliness or her exhaustion. Deciding it was the first, she picked up her Bible from the bedside table and opened it to the New Testament.
"Give me something to hope for, Lord, please," she prayed silently.
Her eyes fell to the words of Christ in Matthew 5:3-5. "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth."
"But, Lord, I already feel like that," Sherry protested. "I feel poor in spirit. I mourn over my life, my marriage, my children. I try to be gentle, but I just feel run over all the time. Where is your promise? Where is your hope? Where are you?"
Sherry waited in the darkened room for an answer. None came. The only sound was the quiet pit-pat of tears running off her cheeks and onto the pages of her Bible. What's the problem? Sherry tries to live her life the right way. She tries to do a good job with her marriage, her children, her job, her relationships, and her Lord. Yet it's obvious that something isn't right. Life isn't working. Sherry's in deep spiritual and emotional pain. Woman or man, we can all identify with Sherry's dilemma, her isolation, her helplessness, her confusion, her guilt, and above all, her sense that her life is out of control. Look closely at Sherry's circumstances. Parts of Sherry's life may be remarkably similar to your own. Understanding her struggle may shed light on yours. You can immediately see a few answers that don't work for Sherry. First, trying harder isn't working. Sherry expends lots of energy trying to have a successful life. She isn't lazy. Second, being nice out of fear isn't working. Sherry's people-pleasing efforts don't seem to bring her the intimacy she needs. Third, taking responsibility for others isn't working. A master of taking care of the feelings and problems of others, Sherry feels like her life is a miserable failure. Sherry's unproductive energy, fearful niceness, and over-responsibility point to the core problem. Sherry suffers from severe difficulties in taking ownership of her life. Back in the Garden of Eden, God told Adam and Eve about ownership. "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Genesis 1:28. Made in the image of God, we were created to take responsibility for certain tasks. Part of taking responsibility, or ownership, is knowing what is our job and what isn't. Workers who continually take on duties that aren't theirs will eventually burn out. It takes wisdom to know what we should be doing and what we shouldn't. We can't do everything. Sherry has great difficulty in knowing what things are her responsibility and what aren't. In her desire to do the right thing, or to avoid conflict, she ends up taking on problems that God never intended her to take on. Her mother's chronic loneliness, her boss's irresponsibility, her friend's unending crises, her church leader's guilt-ridden message of self-sacrifice, and her husband's immaturity. And her problems don't end there. Sherry's inability to say no has significantly affected her son's ability to delay gratification and behave himself in school, and, in some way, this inability may be driving her daughter to withdraw.
Any confusion of responsibility and ownership in our lives is a problem of boundaries. Just as homeowners set physical property lines around their land, we need to set mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual boundaries for our lives to help us distinguish what is our responsibility and what isn't. As we see in Sherry's many struggles, the inability to set appropriate boundaries at appropriate times with the appropriate people can be very destructive. And this is one of the most serious problems facing Christians today. Many sincere, dedicated believers struggle with tremendous confusion about when it is biblically appropriate to set limits. When confronted with their lack of boundaries, they raise good questions. 1. Can I set limits and still be a loving person? 2. What are legitimate boundaries? 3. What if someone is upset or hurt by my boundaries? 4. How do I answer someone who wants my time, love, energy, or money? 5. Why do I feel guilty or afraid when I consider setting boundaries? 6. How do boundaries relate to submission? And 7. Aren't boundaries selfish? Misinformation about the Bible's answers to these issues has led to much wrong teaching about boundaries. Not only that, but many clinical psychological symptoms such as depression, anxiety disorders, eating disorders, addictions, impulsive disorders, guilt problems, shame issues, panic disorders, and marital and relational struggles find their root in conflicts with boundaries. This book presents a biblical view of boundaries, what they are, what they protect, how they are developed, how they are injured, how to repair them, and how to use them. This book will answer the above questions and more. Our goal is to help you use biblical boundaries appropriately to achieve the relationships and purposes that God intends for you as His child. Sherry's knowledge of the Scriptures seems to support her lack of boundaries. This book aims to help you see the deeply biblical nature of boundaries as they operate in the character of God, His universe, and His people. Chapter 2. What does a boundary look like? The parents of a 25-year-old man came to see me with a common request. They wanted me to fix their son, Bill. When I asked where Bill was, they answered, "Oh, he didn't want to come." "Why?" I asked. "Well, he doesn't think he has a problem," they replied. "Maybe he's right," I said, to their surprise. "Tell me about it." They recited a history of problems that had begun at a very young age. Bill had never been quite up to snuff in their eyes. In recent years, he had exhibited problems with drugs and an inability to stay in school and find a career. It was apparent that they loved their son very much and were heartbroken over the way he was living. They had tried everything they knew to get him to change and live a responsible life, but all had failed. He was still using drugs, avoiding responsibility, and keeping questionable company. They told me that they had always given him everything he needed. He had plenty of money at school, so he wouldn't have to work, and he would have plenty of time for study and a social life. When he flunked out of one school or stopped going to classes, they were more than happy to do everything they could to get him into another school, where it might be better for him. After they had talked for a while, I responded, "I think your son is right. He doesn't have a problem." You could have mistaken their expression for a snapshot. They stared at me in disbelief for a full minute. Finally, the father said, "Did I hear you right? You don't think he has a problem?" "That's correct," I said. "He doesn't have a problem. You do. He can do pretty much whatever he wants, no problem. You pay, you fret, you worry, you plan, you exert energy to keep him going. He doesn't have a problem because you have taken it from him.
Those things should be his problem, but as it now stands, they are yours. Would you like for me to help you help him to have some problems?" They looked at me like I was crazy, but some lights were beginning to go on in their heads.
"What do you mean, help him to have some problems?" his mother asked.
"Well," I explained, "I think that the solution to this problem would be to clarify some boundaries so that his actions cause him problems and not you."
"What do you mean, boundaries?" the father asked.
"Look at it this way. It's as if he's your neighbor who never waters his lawn, but whenever you turn on your sprinkler system, the water falls on his lawn. Your grass is turning brown and dying, but Bill looks down at his green grass and thinks to himself, 'My yard is doing fine.' That is how your son's life is. He doesn't study, or plan, or work, yet he has a nice place to live, plenty of money, and all the rights of a family member who is doing his part. If you would define the property lines a little better, if you would fix the sprinkler system so that the water would fall on your lawn, and if he didn't water his own lawn, he would have to live in dirt, he might not like that after a while. As it stands now, he is irresponsible and happy, and you are responsible and miserable. A little boundary clarification would do the trick. You need some fences to keep his problems out of your yard and in his, where they belong."
"Isn't that just a bit cruel, just to stop helping like that?"
the father asked. "Has helping him helped?" I asked. His look told me that he was beginning to understand. Invisible property lines and responsibility. In the physical world, boundaries are easy to see. Fences, signs, walls, moats with alligators, manicured lawns or hedges are all physical boundaries. In their differing appearances, they give the same message. This is where my property begins. The owner of the property is legally responsible for what happens on his or her property. Non-owners are not responsible for the property. Physical boundaries mark a visible property line that someone holds the deed to. You can go to the county courthouse and find out exactly where those boundaries of responsibility are and whom to call if you have business there. In the spiritual world, boundaries are just as real, but often harder to see. The goal of this chapter is to help you define your intangible boundaries and to recognize them as an ever-present reality that can increase your love and save your life. In reality, these boundaries define your soul, and they help you to guard it and maintain it. Proverbs 4:23. Me and not me. Boundaries define us. They define what is me and what is not me. A boundary shows me where I end and someone else begins, leading me to a sense of ownership. Knowing what I am to own and take responsibility for gives me freedom. If I know where my yard begins and ends, I am free to do with it what I like. Taking responsibility for my life opens up many different options. However, if I do not own my life, my choices and options become very limited. Think how confusing it would be if someone told you to guard this property diligently, because I will hold you responsible for what happens here, and then did not tell you the boundaries of the property, or they did not give you the means with which to protect the property. This would be not only confusing, but also potentially dangerous. This is exactly what happens to us emotionally and spiritually, however. God designed a world where we all live within ourselves, that is, we inhabit our own souls, and we are responsible for the things that make up us. The heart knows its own bitterness, and no one shares its joy. Proverbs 14:10. We have to deal with what is in our soul, and boundaries help us to define what that is. If we are not shown the parameters, or are taught wrong parameters, we are in for much pain. The Bible tells us clearly what our parameters are and how to protect them.
But often our family or other past relationships confuse us about our parameters. In addition to showing us what we are responsible for, boundaries help us to define what is not on our property and what we are not responsible for. We are not, for example, responsible for other people. Nowhere are we commanded to have other control, although we spend a lot of time and energy trying to get it. 2 and 4. We are responsible to others and for ourselves. Carry each other's burdens, says Galatians 6:2, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. This verse shows our responsibility to one another. Many times others have burdens that are too big to bear. They do not have enough strength, resources, or knowledge to carry the load, and they need help. Denying ourselves to do for others what they cannot do for themselves is showing the sacrificial love of Christ. This is what Christ did for us. He did what we could not do for ourselves. He saved us. This is being responsible too. On the other hand, verse 5 says that each one should carry his own load. Everyone has responsibilities that only he or she can carry. These things are our own particular load that we need to take daily responsibility for and work out. No one can do certain things for us. We have to take ownership of certain aspects of life that are our own load. The Greek words for burden and load give us insight into the meaning of these texts. The Greek word for burden means excess burdens, or burdens that are so heavy that they weigh us down. These burdens are like boulders. They can crush us. We shouldn't be expected to carry a boulder by ourselves. It would break our backs. We need help with the boulders, those times of crisis and tragedy in our lives. In contrast, the Greek word for load means cargo, or the burden of daily toil. This word describes the everyday things we all need to do. These loads are like knapsacks. Knapsacks are possible to carry. We are expected to carry our own. We are expected to deal with our own feelings, attitudes, and behaviors, as well as the responsibilities God has given to each one of us, even though it takes effort. Problems arise when people act as if their boulders are daily loads and refuse help, or as if their daily loads are boulders they shouldn't have to carry. The results of these two instances are either perpetual pain or irresponsibility. Lest we stay in pain or become irresponsible, it is very important to determine what me is, where my boundary of responsibility is, and where someone else's begins. We will define what we are responsible for later in this chapter. For now, let's look more closely at the nature of boundaries. Good in, bad out. Boundaries help us to distinguish our property so that we can take care of it. They help us to guard our heart with all diligence. We need to keep things that will nurture us inside our fences and keep things that will harm us outside. In short, boundaries help us keep the good in and the bad out. They guard our treasures, Matthew 7:6, so that people will not steal them. They keep the pearls inside and the pigs outside. Sometimes we have bad on the inside and good on the outside. In these instances, we need to be able to open up our boundaries to let the good in and the bad out. In other words, our fences need gates in them. For example, if I find that I have some pain or sin within, I need to open up and communicate it to God and others so that I can be healed. Confessing pain and sin helps to get it out,
so that it does not continue to poison me on the inside. 1 John 1:9, James 5:16, Mark 7:21-23. And when the good is on the outside, we need to open our gates and let it in. Jesus speaks of this phenomenon in receiving him and his truth, Revelation 3:20, John 1:12. Other people have good things to give us, and we need to open up to them. 2 Corinthians 6:11-13. Often we will close our boundaries to good things from others, staying in a state of deprivation. In short, boundaries are not walls. The Bible does not say that we are to be walled off from others. In fact, it says that we are to be one with them. John 17:11. We are to be in community with them. But in every community, all members have their own space and property. The important thing is that property lines be permeable enough to allow passing and strong enough to keep out danger. Often, when people are abused while growing up, they reverse the function of boundaries and keep the bad in and the good out. When Mary was growing up, she suffered abuse from her father. She was not encouraged to develop good boundaries. As a result, she would close herself off, holding the pain inside. She would not open up to express her hurt and get it out of her soul. She also would not open up to let support from the outside in to heal her. In addition, she would continually allow others to dump more pain into her soul. Consequently, when she came in for help, she was carrying a lot of pain, still being abused and walled off from support from the outside. She had to reverse the ways her boundaries worked. She needed fences that were strong enough to keep the bad out, and gates in those fences to let out the bad already in her soul and let in the good she desperately needed. God and boundaries. The concept of boundaries comes from the very nature of God. God defines himself as a distinct, separate being, and he is responsible for himself. He defines and takes responsibility for his personality by telling us what he thinks, feels, plans, allows, will not allow, likes and dislikes. He also defines himself as separate from his creation and from us. He differentiates himself from others. He tells us who he is and who he is not. For example, he says that he is love and that he is not darkness. 1 John 4:16-16. In addition, he has boundaries within the Trinity. The Father, the Son, and the Spirit are one, but at the same time they are distinct persons with their own boundaries. Each one has his own personhood and responsibilities, as well as a connection and love for one another. John 17:24. God also limits what he will allow in his yard. He confronts sin and allows consequences for behavior. He guards his house and will not allow evil things to go on there. He invites people in who will love him, and he lets his love flow outward to them at the same time. The gates of his boundaries open and close appropriately. In the same way he gave us his likeness, Genesis 1:26, he gave us personal responsibility within limits. He wants us to rule and subdue the earth and to be responsible stewards over the life he has given us. To do that, we need to develop boundaries like God's. Examples of boundaries. Boundaries are anything that helps to differentiate you from someone else, or shows where you begin and end. Here are some examples of boundaries. Skin. The most basic boundary that defines you is your physical skin. People often use this boundary as a metaphor for saying that their personal boundaries have been violated. He really gets under my skin.
Your physical self is the first way that you learn that you are separate from others. As an infant, you slowly learn that you are different from the mother or father who cuddles you. The skin boundary keeps the good in and the bad out. It protects your blood and bones, holding them on the inside and all together. It also keeps germs outside, protecting you from infection. At the same time, skin has openings that let the good in, like food, and the bad out, like waste products. Victims of physical and sexual abuse often have a poor sense of boundaries. Early in life, they were taught that their property did not really begin at their skin. Others could invade their property and do whatever they wanted. As a result, they have difficulty establishing boundaries later in life. Words. In the physical world, a fence or some other kind of structure usually delineates a boundary. In the spiritual world, fences are invisible. Nevertheless, you can create good protective fences with your words. The most basic boundary-setting word is no. It lets others know that you exist apart from them and that you are in control of you. Being clear about your no and your yes is a theme that runs throughout the Bible. Matthew 5:37, James 5:12. No is a confrontational word. The Bible says that we are to confront people we love, saying, "No, that behavior is not okay. I will not participate in that." The word no is also important in setting limits on abuse. Many passages of Scripture urge us to say no to others' sinful treatment of us. Matthew 18:15-20. The Bible also warns us against giving to others reluctantly or under compulsion. 2 Corinthians 9:7. People with poor boundaries struggle with saying no to the control, pressure, demands, and sometimes the real needs of others. They feel that if they say no to someone, they will endanger their relationship with that person, so they passively comply, but inwardly resent. Sometimes a person is pressuring you to do something. Other times the pressure comes from your own sense of what you should do. If you cannot say no to this external or internal pressure, you have lost control of your property and are not enjoying the fruit of self-control. Your words also define your property for others as you communicate your feelings, intentions, or dislikes. It is difficult for people to know where you stand when you do not use words to define your property. God does this when He says, "I like this and I hate that," or "I will do this and I will not do that." Your words let people know where you stand and thus give them a sense of the edges that help identify you. "I don't like it when you yell at me," gives people a clear message about how you conduct relationships and lets them know the rules of your yard. Truth. Knowing the truth about God and His property puts limits on you and shows you His boundaries. Realizing the truth of His unchangeable reality helps you to define yourself in relation to Him. When He says that you will reap what you sow, Galatians 6:7, for example, you either define yourself in relation to that reality or continue to get injured if you try to go against it. To be in touch with God's truth is to be in touch with reality, and to live in accord with that reality makes for a better life. Psalm 119:2-45. Satan is the great distorter of reality. Recall in the garden when he tempted Eve to question God's boundaries and His truth. The consequences were disastrous. There is always safety in the truth, whether it be knowing God's truth or knowing the truth about yourself. Many people live scattered and tumultuous lives, trying to live outside of their own boundaries, not accepting and expressing the truth of who they are. Honesty about who you are gives you the biblical value of integrity or oneness. Geographical distance.
Proverbs 22:3 says that, "The prudent man sees the evil and hides himself." Sometimes physically removing yourself from a situation will help maintain boundaries. You can do this to replenish yourself physically, emotionally, and spiritually after you have given to your limit, as Jesus often did. Or you can remove yourself to get away from danger and put limits on evil. The Bible urges us to separate from those who continue to hurt us and to create a safe place for ourselves. Removing yourself from the situation will also cause the one who is left behind to experience a loss of fellowship that may lead to changed behavior. Matthew 18:17-18, 1 Corinthians 5:11-13. When a relationship is abusive, many times the only way to finally show the other person that your boundaries are real is to create space until they are ready to deal with the problem. The Bible supports the idea of limiting togetherness for the sake of binding evil. Time. Taking time off from a person or a project can be a way of regaining ownership over some out-of-control aspect of your life where boundaries need to be set. Adult children who have never spiritually and emotionally separated from their parents often need time away. They have spent their whole lives embracing and keeping, Ecclesiastes 3:5-6, and have been afraid to refrain from embracing and to throw away some of their outgrown ways of relating. They need to spend some time building boundaries against the old ways and creating new ways of relating that for a while may feel alienating to their parents. This time apart usually improves their relationship with their parents. Emotional distance. Emotional distance is a temporary boundary to give your heart the space it needs to be safe. It is never a permanent way of living. People who have been in abusive relationships need to find a safe place to begin to thaw out emotionally. Sometimes, in abusive marriages, the abused spouse needs to keep emotional distance until the abusive partner begins to face his or her problems and become trustworthy. You should not continue to set yourself up for hurt and disappointment. If you have been in an abusive relationship, you should wait until it is safe and until real patterns of change have been demonstrated before you go back. Many people are too quick to trust someone in the name of forgiveness and not make sure that the other is producing fruit in keeping with repentance. Luke 3:8. To continue to open yourself up emotionally to an abusive or addicted person without seeing true change is foolish. Forgive, but guard your heart until you see sustained change. Other people. You need to depend on others to help you set and keep boundaries. People subject to another person's addictions, control, or abuse are finding that after years and years of loving too much, they can find the ability to create boundaries only through a support group. Their support system is giving them the strength to say no to abuse and control for the first time in their lives. There are two reasons why you need others to help with boundaries. The first is that your most basic need in life is for relationship. People suffer much to have relationships, and may put up with abuse because they fear their partners will leave them, and they will be alone if they stand up to them. Fear of being alone keeps many in hurtful patterns for years. They are afraid that if they set boundaries, they will not have any love in their life. When they open themselves up to support from others, however, they find that the abusive person is not the only source of love in the world, and that they can find the strength through their support system to set the limits they need to set. They are no longer alone. The Church of Christ is there to give strength to ward off the blows against them. The other reason we need others is because we need new input and teaching. Many people have been taught by their church or their family that boundaries are unbiblical, mean, or selfish. These people need good,
biblical support systems to help them stand against the guilt that comes from the old tapes inside that tell them lies to keep them in bondage. They need